Yes.
Yep.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, I said this in my email to y'all. It feels like a million years since we've had a group night, and it's been far too long. Appreciate y'all's flexibility with our COVID shutdown a few weeks ago, and then obviously we had Thanksgiving, but excited to wrap this thing up with you guys tonight. Let me go ahead and pray for our evening, and we'll keep going. God, thank you so much for these men who have just spent time, taking the time to be part of this Bible study this fall. God, we thank you for the Gospel of Mark, and I pray this has just been such a fruitful exercise, both in learning how better to read your word, and as we actually do that, to profit by spending time in your word. I pray we've all grown, and especially, God, as we discuss your word in community with other believers, other men, I pray that this has just been a sharpening experience for all of us involved. So, God, I pray for nothing less for that than tonight, Lord. Tonight would also just be a means of sharpening one another with your word. I pray you'd be with us as we just unpack this very pivotal moment in Mark's gospel. I pray you just open our eyes as we see you do in this passage to see wonderful things from your word. So God, be with us tonight as we discuss your word and its relevance to our lives. Amen. All right. Well, as I just prayed, this is a last session of the fall, and also we're ending on what we've been saying is the climax of Mark's gospel, which is Peter's confession. But we'll get up to there. I want to start. We're starting tonight in verses chapter 7, verse 24. Chapter 7, verse 24. There's a lot of different scenes tonight, so there's a lot happening, but it's a fun section. So this first scene, though, verse 24, the scene where we see Jesus entering this region of Tyre. So Tyre's actually shown up real briefly in Mark's gospel already. Back in Mark chapter 3, verse 8, we saw there's this description of all these people from various regions coming to see coming to Jesus for healing. They want to be near him. And so that included people from Tyre. People from Tyre had come to see Jesus. And so it's possible they went back, talked about Jesus. And so when he shows up here, maybe his reputation's preceded him. We don't know for sure, but it's just interesting to point that out. And sure enough, this woman approaches him. And before we talk about this woman, I think it's helpful to kind of remind ourselves of what's just happened in Mark's gospel. So the beginning of Mark chapter 7, the first 20 or so verses, that was that section where Jesus essentially made the point where he kind of redefined what purity meant to the Pharisees, if you remember that. And he basically came to the conclusion that, hey, what defiles you isn't the food that goes into you. What defiles you is the evil that comes out of you, the evil that comes out of your heart. The problem's not food, it's your heart. And Mark had this editorial comment in verse 19 where he said that in saying this, Jesus declared all food clean. And so Jesus, already in Mark 7, has effectively been opening the doors to God's kingdom for the Gentiles. Essentially, he's breaking down this protective barrier that the Jews of his day had kind of put up to protect their identity and allowing other people to come in. And so tonight, we actually see Jesus doing a lot of ministry among these very people, these Gentiles. And sure enough, this woman is one of them. So Mark, as you notice, hopefully this stood out to you. In verse 26, Mark actually very explicitly makes sure you know this woman's not a Jew. He says that she is a Greek. She's born in Syrophoenicia. She's not a Jew, and he wants us to know that. And so she comes to Jesus. She asks him, maybe she's heard of what he can do, and she has a daughter who has an impure spirit. So she comes begging Jesus to heal her daughter. And we get this like really weird moment in Mark. This is one of those moments for me that Jesus kind of sounds like a jerk, if I'm really honest. The way he responds to her, first of all, it sounds like he's not just refusing her, he's insulting her while he's doing that. He's like, I'm not just going to say no, I'm going to kick you while you're down too. And let's be honest, Jesus kind of sounds mean here. It's like, come on, bro. I think this is a good point to bring out, just a good Bible study tool. Good tool, just the Christian life, but Bible study tool I like to use in these kind of passages is this. Process what you don't understand in light of what you do know about God, okay? Process what you don't know in light of what you do know. And here's what I mean by that here. So, for example, Jesus refusing someone who's desperate and insulting them at the same time doesn't really feel like the Jesus we've seen throughout Mark's gospel or any gospel, right? That would seem odd. So I think that's a clue that something else might be going on here. He's not saying, you're nothing but a dog to me, woman. That's not what's happening here, okay? Secondly, we have to remember that God's plan, ever since the first book of the Bible, Genesis, has been for all people, Jews and Gentiles, to know him, all right? And the whole purpose of God choosing Israel was that they would be that conduit of God's blessing to all nations, okay? And so even later, so Jesus isn't saying that Gentiles, this woman has no claim on God's love. It's not what's going on here. And we have to remember a little bit, well, maybe we haven't got there yet. In Mark chapter 13, Jesus is going to say that the gospel needs to be preached to all nations. And so that's in Jesus's horizon, that the Gentiles need the gospel, all right? The issue seems to be timing, though. Right? Even verse 27, he says this little parable proverb he uses. He's saying about the children eating bread. He says, first let the children eat. And we have to remember that Jesus' primary purpose in his ministry when he first came was to the nation of Israel. Okay? It's not to say he didn't do anything with Gentiles, which we're seeing him do that tonight. But his primary focus was to declare to Israel that their deliverance was at hand. Okay. And for any Jew at the time familiar with the Old Testament, which they would have been, they knew that only when Israel's deliverance was at hand would the Gentile nations come join Israel. That's when the Gentiles would be blessed, is when Israel is restored. So that's Jesus's focus primarily in his ministry. But it's a very temporary focus. After the cross, it's going to be Book of Acts, Jew and Gentile. Paul goes to the Gentiles. As far as the dog's comment, I don't think Jesus is insulting her. Probably what's happening here, I think, is that Jesus is probably testing her. He's probably inviting some kind of response. He's probably answering her in such a way that he's wanting to prod and invite a particular response. You have to remember, in this day, there's a lot of miracle workers, all right? There's a lot of miracle workers. And we've seen in Mark's gospel that Jesus, when he heals someone, he wants them to understand that it was faith that healed them, not just this magic, whatever. So remember the woman in Mark chapter 5 who was bleeding for 12 years. She thought, man, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. She probably thought his cloak was magic. And so sure enough, she does touch the cloak, healed. And then Jesus could have left it there, but he stopped what he was doing and engaged her in dialogue and made it very clear to her that what healed her was her faith, and he made that clear not just for her, but for everyone listening. Jesus wants to respond in faith to people. And I love this woman's response. This woman is awesome. Jesus gives her probably what's a proverb of his day about feeding the children. And, you know, whether she feels insulted by this dog comment, we don't know. Whether she feels insulted or not, she just plows forward. She takes Jesus's words and twists it to her advantage. She's like, all right, dogs eat those crumbs too, that fall. Things fall. And I wish I could have seen Jesus' face in that moment. I imagine a smile coming up on his face. He's like, for that, your daughter's healed. So again, we see Jesus wanting to respond in faith. And this one, he wanted to see if this woman saw him as just another miracle worker or she's actually putting faith in him. And she did, and he healed her for it. And from Tyre, we go to the Decapolis. Once again, this is another region that has shown up in Mark's gospel, okay? Previously, this is where Jesus was when he healed the man who had the thousands of demons living inside him, legion. And if you remember, Jesus, that guy wanted to follow Jesus. He begged Jesus to let him go with him. And Jesus said, go to your own people, tell them what the Lord has done and how he's had mercy on you. And Mark 5:20 says, the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and the people were amazed. And so again, this might be a situation where that man starts evangelizing about Jesus and word about him spreads so that by the time he comes back here in Mark 7, he has some popularity. His reputation precedes him. Sure enough, shows up and we get a group of people bringing a deaf man to him, a deaf and mute man. And there's a few details worth mentioning here that I think are interesting about this man. Some translations say that he had a speech impediment. Some say that he could just hardly talk. And then if you combine that with the fact that once he's healed, he starts talking normally. This is probably a guy who went deaf later in life. He probably was not born deaf. Maybe developed that speech impediment because of that when he went deaf. And maybe you notice this, we'll come back to this in a moment, but if you compare this story with the blind man in chapter 8, there's actually a few similarities between them. For example, Jesus leads this man, the deaf man and the blind man, he leads them away from the crowd, takes them to an isolated spot. There's spit involved in it for some reason. And sure enough, Jesus heals the man. He can see, he can hear, he can speak clearly again. And again, he's trying to keep a low profile as he was in Tyre here. But the more he tries to tell people to not talk about himself, the more people want to talk about him. Okay, and so his popularity again is exploding. I love what they say too. Verse 37 is just such a beautiful passage. It says, people were overwhelmed with amazement. And they said this, he has done everything well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. And I want to highlight a passage in Isaiah, which maybe encourage you to go read later, Isaiah 35. And the reason I bring that up is because by recording this, by recording these words, Mark probably has Isaiah 35 in mind. So we've mentioned a few times in this study that Mark is often brings in this theme of the Exodus, okay? So back in the Old Testament, the Exodus was when God came to his people when they were enslaved in Egypt, rescued them, powerfully rescued them, led them through the wilderness on their way to the promised land. Centuries later, when God kicked them out of that promised land for disobedience, the low moment of Israel's history, the prophets declared that God would one day restore them with a second Exodus. And Mark has been giving us clues, often quoting or alluding to prophets that talk about another Exodus. And we talked about, maybe in the first week or so, that in Mark's mind, that second Exodus has started with Jesus. Isaiah 35 is actually a passage which talks about this new Exodus. And a couple of verses in Isaiah 35 say this, talking about the day when God will redeem his people. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. In this new Exodus, you're going to see the deaf hear, the mute speak, and the blind see. I think Mark is wanting us to have that passage in mind. I encourage you to go read it. Isaiah 35 is a pretty short chapter, but it seems to be in Mark's mind, and Mark references Isaiah often. From there, we get, still in the Decapolis, we get another feeding story. All right, so this is a sequel, right? This is a sequel. We've seen him feed 5,000 people. Now we're going to see him feed 4,000 people. This isn't a complete rehash, though. And I don't know if he actually took time to maybe line them up. There's obviously a lot of similarities between the two. There's some differences, too. A few differences. First of all, this crowd has been with Jesus a lot longer than the other crowd had been. The other crowd had been with Jesus, I think, over the course of an afternoon, maybe a few hours. Here, they've been with him 3 days. They're just listening to this guy teach for 3 days. They're enthralled, right? And so they've been with him 3 days. Secondly, so 3 days, their supplies are by this point running out. Secondly, there don't appear to be any nearby towns that they could theoretically go get food in, like in the previous feeding. And so just those two right there, this isolated location, the length of time they've been with him, it seems to be a much more urgent situation. Another difference, Jesus takes the initiative here, not the disciples. I think the big difference, though, probably most significant to Mark, is the audience of who he's feeding here. So they're in this region of the Decapolis. Decapolis is a predominantly Gentile region, okay? Now, there were sizable Jews living in that area, so it's very likely this is a mixed audience. But even still, he's feeding people in a Gentile region. He's providing to a crowd that's at the very least mixed, if not predominantly Gentiles. And it's interesting to even read this feeding in light of the woman earlier in Mark 7. So now we're actually seeing the Gentiles get to share in that bread that Jesus is providing. We've seen him feed Jews a couple chapters ago. Now he's feeding Jews and Gentiles too. So there's some differences there. And I think we get a preview here of just that though Jesus is primarily concentrated on the Jews, the gospel is not meant to stay with them, but to go out to the whole world. And so then we get this brief encounter with the Pharisees. And this is a very short moment, but it's important because it's going to set up the rest of the chapter. Pharisees come up to Jesus to, quote, question him. And they ask him for a sign from heaven. Question, are these guys legitimately asking because they want to know? No, man, they've made up their minds. They think this guy's crazy and they're just trying to discredit him, right? This is not a good faith question at all from them. To be clear, in Mark's gospel, like a sign, they're not asking for a miracle, okay? They've seen miracles. They've watched him cast out demons. What they're asking for, when Mark says they're asking for a sign, they're asking for Jesus to essentially authenticate what he's doing, like prove that God is the one at work in you, all right? We need to prove that God is okay with you. You've got God's stamp of approval. That's what they're asking for. And I love Jesus' response. Just again, one of these moments as I spend time in this gospel, just I wish I could have seen Jesus. Just like Mark says, he sighed. And I just imagine him like, oh, here we go again. He knows there's nothing he can do to convince these guys, right? And the fact that they're even asking for a sign is an act of unbelief. Like, his life and his works should be enough for those who want to believe. And this reminds me of the end of Mark 2. This is our maybe second session. At the end of Mark 2, if you remember, Jesus heals the paralytic. His buddies brought him to Jesus and he healed him. And then the crowds around, if you remember, said that they watched that and they started praising God. They watched what Jesus did and they rightly understood God was at work here. This is God's doing, so they praised God for that. Another example, I mean, we've seen Jesus cast out demons often in Mark's gospel. And what that should communicate is that Jesus is waging an all-out assault on Satan's kingdom, right? That should be proof that God is at work in Jesus. And yet the Pharisees can't get around that. So they say, oh, you work for Satan. And that was the whole blasphemy of the Holy Spirit thing. It's like, are you serious? That's your solution to why I'm casting out demons? The fact that he's casting out demons is proof that God is with him. But the Pharisees was proof that he was working with Satan. They're just so blind. They're so determined to resist this guy. So Jesus' deeds, his words, should have told them all they needed to know about his significance. And that brings us to this scene with the disciples, okay? So he leaves the Pharisees, they get in a boat, and he is with his disciples. Disciples realize something. They don't have enough bread. They have one loaf of bread in their boat. Sounds like they're probably playing the blame game, like who left it, whose job was it? And then Jesus has this cryptic saying. He said, hey, be careful. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. So yeast is being used metaphorically, as it often is in the Bible, for influence, oftentimes for bad influence. And Jesus is saying that, basically, he's warning the disciples. He's making the point that they're in danger of having the same defiling attitude as the Pharisees that he was just talking to, and the Herodians. Because like them, the disciples have missed the significance of Jesus' deeds. Specifically, they've missed the significance of this feeding of the 4,000. And I love that when Jesus says, hey, like, maybe you notice this, when Jesus says, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod, like, the only word they seem to hear is yeast. So they think Jesus is talking about bread. They like conveniently don't hear Herod and Pharisees, which should have clued them in that, hey, maybe Jesus is actually talking about literal bread here, but something different. And Jesus' point seems to be this in this passage, the scene in the boat. His point is that these two feedings, he brings up the feeding of the 5,000. He's like, man, you've watched me do this twice. You've watched me feed 5,000. You've watched me feed 4,000. And this should have clued them in, his point seems to be, of who he is. That he is this Messiah. I mean, think about the situation. They've watched Jesus do this twice and they're worried that they have one piece of bread. Lack of bread isn't the problem, right? They've seen that very clearly. Lack of bread has never been a problem for Jesus. He can just multiply it. And they're so concerned about their next meal that they've missed what Jesus' deed of doing that should have been telling them about his identity, all right? But they don't get it. They seem clueless. And Mark in this section is really honing in on their hard-heartedness. And he's basically putting them in the category of people back in chapter 4 when he's talking about the parables of those on the outside who don't get it. And there's some important verses here. Jesus says this in the middle. Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still see, or do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see? Do you have ears but fail to hear? Jesus calls them deaf and blind here. And here's why I bring that up. Jesus is calling them deaf and blind. And we've just seen what Jesus can do to a deaf man. And now Mark proceeds to show us what Jesus can do to a blind man. And I'll be honest, this part where Jesus heals the blind man, if I can make a plug for something we've talked about in this Bible study of repetitive reading, when I was first sitting down to read this passage, knowing how significant the confession of Peter is right after this, this story felt very random to me. Like, why is Mark detoured to talk about this blind man? And so I read it several times, and then some connections started to make sense, particularly that Jesus calls them deaf and blind. And we see Jesus heal a deaf and blind man pretty close together. So similarities here, as I mentioned, with the deaf man. Some people bring this guy to Jesus. Jesus, for reasons Mark does not quite explain, leads the man away from the crowd. There's spit involved again. And like the deaf man, this man probably was not born blind. He at least knows what trees look like. There's some unique elements, though, to this story that don't show up in any of the other Gospels. This is kind of a weird story, and maybe you notice that. Jesus asking if the healing is effective. We've never seen him do that, and you won't see him do that ever again in the Gospels. The fact that the healing was only partial. The fact that there's a second touch. Jesus touches him once. He's partially healed. He touches him again. He's fully healed. And no other place do you see a two-stage healing from Jesus, which is interesting. And Mark is not really interested in telling us why this happened. I don't know. Maybe this man didn't have enough faith after the first touch. We don't know. We don't know, but Mark, if Mark isn't interested in explaining why it happened, here's what he is interested in. So Jesus has just called his disciples deaf and blind. We've witnessed Jesus healing a deaf man. We're now witnessing him healing a blind man. And significantly, we're seeing him heal this blind man in stages. His sight is not restored all at once, but gradually. Okay? Mark seems to intend for us as readers of his gospel to have this miracle in mind and how he performed this miracle when we read what happens next. Okay? The climactic moments of Mark's gospel. And I'll explain that. So we get to this moment, verses 27 through 30 in chapter 8. Finally, they seem to get it, at least somewhat. Jesus asks them, who do people say that I am? And they say, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say the prophets. We saw these same three options back when we read about John the Baptist being beheaded with Herod. And whoever people think Jesus might be, they think at best he serves as just a preparation for God's Messiah. So he asks who people say that I am, and then I love this. He says, who do you say that I am? Turns the question on them. Who do you say that I am? And remember, something I said maybe very, very first week is that question of Jesus' identity is like the red thread that goes throughout this entire gospel. It's one of the predominant themes of Mark, is who is this guy? So Jesus is now voicing that very question. And then Peter gives an answer, where for only the second time in Mark's gospel do we see the word Christ or Messiah show up. He says, you are the Christ. showed up in verse 1 of chapter 1, and we haven't heard that word since. You are the Messiah. You are the Christ. Peter's saying, you are God's appointed agent. You're the one through whom all of God's promises will be fulfilled. You are the fulfillment of all Israel's hopes. You are the Messiah. And then Jesus does what we've seen him do several times in Mark, right? He commands silence. So why? Once again, Messiah only communicates so much, okay? If Jesus were to just go around saying, I'm the Messiah, that word is going to mean different things to different people. And for some people, that word is going to mean, this is the deliverer who's going to raise up an army of Jews and drive out Rome. He's a military, nationalistic ruler. And that wasn't what Jesus came to do. And here's why Mark placing the blind man narrative right before this is significant. The blind man was healed in stages. You know, he saw men walking like trees before he could see clearly. Peter can only partially see here. In fact, Matthew's gospel brings this out. When Peter makes his confession, Jesus says, flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father. My Father is behind the fact that you can confess me as the Messiah. So Peter's right. He has now been given eyes to see that this is God's Messiah, but he is still partially blind, okay? He's only experienced that first touch, so to speak. Jesus is the Messiah. And to start kind of dipping our toes into where we're going in the spring, if we can kind of jump ahead a little bit, Jesus essentially after this will say, you're right. Peter is gloriously right. Jesus is the Messiah. But immediately after this, Jesus effectively says, now let me explain to you what that means. Because Peter has his own idea of what a Messiah is, but now Jesus is going to explain that as God's Messiah, I must suffer and die. And we see Peter's partial healing in the fact that he starts to rebuke Jesus for that. He's not like, cool, whatever, I trust you. He's like, no, that's not what a Messiah does. And Jesus calls him Satan. It's a great scene. We'll start there in February. Peter isn't okay with that. He rebukes Jesus. So Peter's still not fully healed. Peter is, as it were, seeing men walking around as trees. True sight, which Peter lacks at this moment, means not just knowing that Jesus is the Messiah, but as God's Messiah, he is to suffer and die. So Peter's right about him being the Messiah, but he has no idea yet about the implications, what that involves. And that's where we're going to pick up in the spring, is what are the implications of Jesus being Messiah? And so after this moment, Mark's gospel takes a drastic shift, huge change in tone from here on out. Up till now, the focus in Mark is going to be on the cost of discipleship. The cost of discipleship, the fact that Jesus himself hit the road he is meant to walk is going to end in suffering and death, and eventually glory, we get there. But that also, as followers of Christ, which includes us today, following him is that same path. A path of suffering, a path of great cost, all right? And so this is where Mark's gospel pivots. And Mads, I love, again, just the fact that it took Jesus' power to open blind eyes. We saw him do that physically, but Mark wants us to see that it requires that same power from Jesus to open blind eyes. And I think that's worth just appreciating as Christians. If you are a Christian, to be a Christian is to be someone whose eyes have been opened, right? Which is something we should constantly be thanking God for. I think it gives us encouragement, too, for those in our lives whose eyes have not been opened. If Jesus can heal blind eyes, he can heal that person too. And I think that's a powerful reminder for us, and we share with those people. So why don't you guys go and split up and continue talking through just the application portions of this section. Let me pray real quick and I'll dismiss you guys. God, we thank you for this passage. We thank you for this moment, Mark's gospel of sight, for being merciful with your disciples, You warn them against being deaf and blind, and yet you heal, we see, deaf and blind people. God, I thank you that they were not beyond your patience or your power. And I pray you to remind us of that too as Christians. The fact that we are Christians is because of a miracle from you. May we always be grateful for that. God, I pray that would give us hope for those in our lives who don't yet know Jesus. Lord, that you would open their eyes. And may we always be in prayer for them that you would do just that. We thank you that you're a God who heals. And God, I pray, God, as we gear up for this second half of Mark, that you would prepare our hearts for what it means to follow you and the great cost involved. Jesus, you don't call us to a path you did not walk yourself. And I pray we would remember that as men. Be with us as we discuss the relevance of this passage for our lives. Lord, we need you. We pray this in your name. Amen.